The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada from Studio Winterthur. I'm Hugh Hewitt live. Good to talk to you. I hope you're having a good morning. Afghanistan isn't the biggest story of the day in terms of actual human impact. It's the massive earthquake that hit along the Pakistan border within Afghanistan. Paktika is the province in which it struck, and more than 1,000 are dead. And the rule of five applies with every third world country, which is when they say 1,000 people are dead, you can multiply that by five, and you've begun to get the estimate. It's a pretty devastating earthquake. Your prayers and your donations will be solicited. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said in a statement, the United States will be providing humanitarian aid. Of course we will. We always do. Those poor people, though, are going to be at the mercy of the Taliban Ministry of Disasters, or whatever they call it. They're not particularly good at this. They're good at war, and they've been very good at war for many, many decades, sort of. They've been good at guerrilla war. Organizing a relief for a massive earthquake? I don't think so. Now, let me turn to the United States. My phone number is 1-800-520-1234. You're up early, you're about to get in your car. Do you know that the president was thinking about you yesterday? He was out there. He really has you on his mind and how much you're paying for gas. He really cares. He really, really cares. So he's reset. It's Joe Biden out there talking to people about high gas prices. I did some research this morning, and if you go to Hugh Hewitt on Twitter, you will find a wonderful poster. We're on our way. It takes 2 million gallons of high-octane gasoline to put 1,000 planes over Germany. Stick to your job. Oil is ammunition. And a link to a wonderful National Institute of Standards article on the pipelines that were built in 1 year. Took 1 year. Construction began in June of 1942 and was completed by June of 1943 on two pipelines from Texas to the Northeast that saved our tankers having to go from the Gulf around Florida up to the Northeast to ship the oil because, of course, the U-boats were out there shooting. So we had to build a bunch of pipelines in a hurry and refinery capacity, and we did. That's what the Defense Production Act exists for. So yesterday, the president, aware that the American driving public does not particularly care for $5 gas gallon, and that, by the way, is cheaper than I paid on the drive north. This is the president cut number one yesterday.
So for all those Republicans in Congress criticizing me today for high gas prices in America, are you now saying we were wrong to support Ukraine? Are you saying we were wrong to stand up to Putin? Are you saying that we would rather have lower gas prices in America and Putin's iron fist in Europe? I don't believe that.
I think that's actually moronic. I believe that is actually the statement of someone who has no idea what they're talking about. You can have both. You can hold two thoughts. We ought to oppose Putin, and we did, and we ought to use the Defense Production Act to ramp up production of oil and gas in the United States, permit refineries, expedite pipelines, reverse our dozens of executive orders that we signed on the first day in office. It's really moronic to say that you have to be for high gas prices or for Ukraine. You can't be both. For low gas prices or for Ukraine. You can't be both. I am for sending everything that isn't nailed down to Ukraine, and I am for low gas prices. And we can have both, and you know it, and I know it. What do you think about the presidents? You can be for Ukraine, or you can be for low gas prices, but you can't be both. 1-800-520-1234. Why are we closing refineries? Because the market's forward-looking. No one wants to invest in something you're going to destroy in 10 years as soon as you get your breath, as soon as people aren't watching. Everybody knows what the Green New Deal is, solar panels and electric cars, which won't go where you need them to go, and trucks that won't carry what you need to carry. It's all a mirage. It's stupid. It's just stupid. I'm for doing all of the above. Make as much solar power as you can, as much natural gas, which is clean as you can, as much nuclear that you will not build, which could power those electric cars. But you are living in a fantasy land, President Biden. He goes on to tell, I love this, cut number two.
To the companies running gas stations and setting those prices at the pump, this is a time of war, global peril, Ukraine. These are not normal times. Bring down the price you are charging at the pump to reflect the cost you are paying for the product.
Let's stop right there. It's the gas station owner's fault. He's not, she's not supposed to make any money. The oil company is not supposed to make any money. The price of oil in a worldwide market is driven by the supply and the demand. People want to use gasoline. They want to go places. You know, I'm in the way north. You got to drive. I'm up in Maine. That's where I am. I'm in Maine. And if you want to go anywhere in Maine, add an hour. I've learned that. Add an hour. And I've got great people that helped me build this studio. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Troy. Thank you, everyone. Generalissimo came up here and got this thing going. And to get here, you can't get here from there. That's an old Yankee thing. But then they went out to Bert and I went out to Muskegon Farm, and we were asked how to get to the Winterthur studio. You can't get there from here. That's, you know, the only bad thing about being here is Red Sox fans, New England Patriots fans, and Celtics fans. Unfortunately, they're everywhere. That's the bad thing about Maine. Now, the good thing about Maine is nobody comes to visit you because they can't afford to get here. Honest to goodness, people can't drive here. And when they do, they'll be broke at the end and they may stay forever. So I'm not really inviting anyone. But if you want to go anywhere this summer, you're going to need a new president. My number is 1-800-520-1234. Have you changed your summer plans because of Joe Biden's gas prices? Another Joe Biden. Cut number three.
I know my Republican friends claim we're not producing enough oil and I'm limiting oil production. Quite frankly, that's nonsense.
All right. Who do you believe, me or your lying eyes? Joe Biden is saying, do you believe me? I'm not doing a thing. I didn't cancel the Keystone Pipeline. I did not. That's what Joe Biden is saying. Do not remember that I canceled the Keystone Pipeline. Now, there are two of them. And every time I say that, people say, well, the first one is going. Well, yes, but the second one would have doubled the amount of oil that we got from. It's done. It's finished. It's gone. Oh, do not pay attention to the fact that we pulled back leases in the Gulf of Mexico. Do not pay attention to the fact that we canceled leases in Alaska. We've got 9,000 permits outstanding. Do you know whenever you hear that, think to yourself, did you instruct the Environmental Protection Agency, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to set aside their objections to those permits and to expedite them, as you could do under the Defense Production Act? Because you know as well as I do, that is why they are not being used, is you just can't get a permit to drill. You also need to get a permit to get a pipeline to the drilling facility. You also need to get the endangered species, the wetlands, the EPA approval, the 404 permit. I did this for 30 years. I'm retired. I don't do this anymore. But if you believe the president, you are really, really out of luck. Cut number four.
We're investing almost $100 billion in public transit and rail.
That's okay. Stop right there. That's going to help you a lot, isn't it? I know a lot of you are just waiting for the public transit and the rail to get to you. Why don't we build pipelines and refineries? Whenever he says public transit and rail, if all the money the president had put into Amtrak, which is a dang useless public subsidy, had been put into refineries and pipelines, we'd be fine right now because we got plenty of oil in the United States. We got plenty of coal and we could build nuclear plants. But this president is anti-energy because he's got his. He's got his beach house. He's got his mansion. He's got his White House. He's got his tenure. And he does not care about you. 1-800-520-1234. What's changed in your life for your summer because of Joe Biden's gas hike, his gas prices? I am Hugh Hewitt. Give me a call. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by former Missouri Senator Jim Talent. You can follow Jim at Twitter at Jim Talent. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
I'm doing fine, you. And gas prices in Missouri about $4.60, $4.65 a gallon. I'm driving to mid-Missouri tonight and back, and that's going to cost me probably $50-$60.
Now, I got to ask you, you've known Joe Biden a long time. You've served alongside him a long time. You've known Joe Biden a long time. What doesn't he understand about gas prices? You have to produce more oil. It is that, and you have to refine more oil into gasoline, and you have to deliver it to the gas station. It's not that hard.
No, it isn't, but you have to understand how politicians think, okay? So they think, I'll say we think, by a process of elimination. So if there's a policy that politically you cannot advocate, you orient your thinking away from it. And he cannot advocate for increasing the supply of oil and gas because he is tied at the hip with the climate change agenda, which for years now has been defined as raising energy prices and getting rid of fossil fuels. That's why he promised the little girl on the campaign trail that he was going to eliminate fossil fuels. So this is a feature of his program, not a bug. And for him to switch at this point would be not only denying his political supporters, but also admitting that everything he's done to this point is wrong. So he can't do that. So he's trying to sell anything else but that. That's what I think is going on. Does that make any sense?
It does, but they are looking at a red wave bigger than anything save 2010 when they took everyone's health insurance away. Now they're taking away everyone's mobility. So I don't think it's actually possible for them to lose 63 seats like Barack Obama did in 2010, because there aren't that many seats to lose. But they could lose 25 or 30. It might be the largest Republican majority. What would the Republicans do with the majority? And by the way, I saw polls yesterday that said Republicans are behind in Wisconsin, PA, and North Carolina. I don't believe them. I don't believe any of these polls. Not a one, Jim Talent.
I don't either. I think the Democrats going to lose seats that aren't on the radar screen now, although I'm starting I'm starting to cut back on saying that publicly because I also believe in luck and I don't want to jinx what's going to happen. Well, listen, if he had the political chops to do it and the Republicans take control of the Congress, he can then triangulate with the Republicans and his own supporters. So in other words, he can grudgingly permit the Republicans to do what he knows we really need to do. That's what Clinton did in the 90s. Now, the problem is he's not Clinton when it comes to either functioning as president or managing the politics of the job. So
Bill Clinton was at least 30 years younger than the president is, at least.
Yeah.
I think he was 35 years younger than the president.
Right, but you know, in all candor, Biden was never that good. So, and now he's impaired. I mean, I don't like to say it that way, but I just think you begin to look silly if you try to avoid saying that sort of thing. But I mean, but he can't do that until the Republicans take control. You remember what Clinton did after he won in '94? He got up and said the era of big government is over, and then he governed with us. And we actually got a lot done in the 90s.
The Criminal Reform Act that the current president helped co-author, that he now repudiates, oil and gas production. You know, Senator, it would require a coming to reality moment for the Green New Deal people. They have to. Energy is freedom and the country is built on freedom. And we don't want what they are selling. And they've never sold it honestly. Now we see it.
And you're right in principle, but the way I talk about it, because I just think it's a people issue. Access to affordable and reliable energy is an essential foundation of quality of life. And you're hearing this now from people calling in. In other words, we need to be able to have access to energy, electricity and automobile fuel primarily, okay, in order to sustain a reasonable quality of life for people. And we're now getting on the edge of not being able to do that. And you're seeing the outcome in the lives of real people. OK, there's enormous suffering already and it's going to get worse. I'm reading we're going to have brownouts. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. It isn't just production, the production side of it. But, you know, if we have a major brownout in the middle of the summer or the middle of the winter, you saw what happened in Texas. Right. When they went off the grid.
Senator, can I ask you, if we spent $2 trillion on infrastructure. How can we not have a grid that works? It's honest to goodness. How can we not have a grid if we just spent $2 trillion on infrastructure?
Yeah, well, I mean, grid issues are to a significant extent state issues. And, you know, there's all kinds of reasons. I got heavily into that when I was in the Energy Committee. But the point is, you got to produce it before you can distribute it, right? And you got to produce automobile fuel, and you got to produce electricity.
And by the way, you got to build nuclear plants.
If the electricity goes out, we're not flying it in from Europe. It's not like baby porn.
you are absolutely right. If the juice goes down, you can't say to the Germans, send us your mothballed nuclear plant. It was all predictable. It's all crazy. Jim Talent is always good to talk to you. Follow him on Twitter at Jim Talent. Sorry about the $60, but compared to Trucker Chris, that's nothing. More of your complaining, because I want to hear from you, because maybe someone in Washington will, because they always listen to the UUH show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Bonjour, hi Canada, I'm Hugh Hewitt. By tonight, we might be talking about Supreme Court decisions. They will be issuing earlier in the day than Brett Baer, my next guest. Host special report tonight at 6. Good morning, Brett. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh.
I have a question for you. You wrote a bestseller, To Rescue the Republic, about Ulysses S. Grant. Politico has a story this morning about books that have been written by Trump aides. Mark Meadows sold a grand total of 21,500 books. Deborah Birx's memoir sold 6,000 copies. Scott Atlas sold 27. Ben Carson, 21,000. Kellyanne Conway did slightly better, 42,000. Mark Esper only sold 20,000. Bill Barr has done pretty good, 64,000, and his numbers are still rising. To what do you attribute these miserable sales?
It's interesting. I think that, there is a perception about... First of all, I think, the tell-all thing hasn't really worked overall as far as numbers. And once you get a mass number of them, it's like, I think I've already been told all. So I think Barr's book was more of a success because of it dealt with a lot of different years in his time as Attorney General and George H.W. Bush and other things besides the Trump years. I feel like everything we've heard every element of it. So there's maybe not a new feeling to it. Now, I will say that the anti-Trump books seem to do pretty well, even though there's a slew of those. And, maybe you attribute that to where they're marketed and how they're marketed.
I don't want to disappoint fans of the former president, but in fact, John Bolton's book sold 680,000 copies. Jim Comey's book sold 626,000, but he was president then, Brett. That's the big difference. They're not appealing to the history audience. They're appealing to left, right, and center, what's going on in the White House. And memoirs don't do that. Bill Barr did well because it's a really good memoir, maybe the best political memoir that I have read in the last 10 years because it goes back so far, and it's funny. And I don't know how many books To Rescue the Republic did. That's for a different market. That's for people who are readers, right? That's for people who love history.
Yeah, we're about 150,000 right now.
Wow! For a book about Ulysses Grant in the 1864. That's just amazing. That's actually kind of amazing.
It's really actually been amazing to watch, this evolution of these history books. I did Eisenhower and then Reagan and FDR, Churchill and Stalin, and then went to Grant. And each book has done better as far as total sales. And I think it's just this hunger to look to our past, to where we've been, and how we as a country may be there again in these different iterations of leaders and how they handle crises.
I also think To Rescue the Republic had a happy medium. It was a lot, but it wasn't too much. Some of the biographers who drop 2,000 pages on you, they're not going to get the American public to read it, Brett. It's just, that's not going to work.
That's the equation that I think is a balancing act. I mean, you want all the detail, you want all the nuance, you want everything, but you also want to be able to read it on the beach in a week or less. And,
Daniel Silva's new book is coming out and it arrives. I get a galley pretty soon. And that's what I'm reading on my way to Chautauqua this weekend. Brett, I have been doing 2 hours on gas prices. I can do 20 hours on gas prices. I'm going to do gas prices all summer. I don't know how much time you spend on Special Report, but there's actually an unlimited supply of people who want to complain and kvetch about gas prices. How often are you? It's actually got more supply than anything else in the world are people who are upset about gas prices. What are you doing about the story on Special Report? Because it's the same story every day. We're screwed.
Yeah, basically. You know, we had an industry expert yesterday on, Kevin Book, who's really good and talking plain speak about some of the things that are talking points. You hear the president saying they have 9,000 leases. They have 9,000 leases. And there's no retort to any reporter to push back. Well, leases and permits are two different things.
Very different.
The environmental restrictions that are put on, that were put on at the beginning of the Biden administration, are a chokehold in some of these aspects on refineries and how the industry overall operates. And that is not easy to put on a bumper sticker, and it's not been pushed back on the administration. So we take time to go through both sides of this, all sides of this, and I agree, you could do a lot of stories about it. There's a lot of different elements to it.
For 30 years, I was a land use lawyer, and I represented an energy company and pipeline companies, and the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, and permit approval from the EPA, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are not easily obtained. So the number of leases and the number of permits, I'm glad you cover it. It seems to mystify the White House press corps. Talk to me a little bit about the war in Ukraine and the president's approach that it's Putin's price hike. I don't think the American public is buying it. What do you think?
I agree. I think it's, you know, and I think Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, kind of undercut the president's message on Capitol Hill yesterday by saying inflation was going up significantly before any movement by Putin. I think that the more the president says that, the more there's a disconnect between what's coming out of the White House and what people are feeling day to day. I also think that, you know, there's a lot that you could go back to candidate Biden saying, we're going to eliminate fossil fuels. Look at me in my eyes. We're going to eliminate fossil fuels. And there are a number of different times he says that. Well, if you quote those quotes from candidate Biden and to the White House or to the president and say, how could you say that someone can believe you when you say you're doing everything you can when this was your set goal? And you have the energy secretary saying, really, we need to make the transition now to green energy. Well, that doesn't say that you're doing everything you can to lower gas prices.
Yeah, agreed. Brett, last question. Yesterday, the Marquette University poll came out and it said that Ron Johnson is losing the reelection campaign. I don't believe that, by the way. Wisconsin was the scene of the worst polling fail in 2020. The ABC Washington Post poll put President Biden 17 points ahead of President Trump 1 week before the election, October 28th.
Okay.
And it was a 0.6 percentage difference, 20,000 votes. They had the Marquette University poll had Biden winning by 5%. Again, it was a 0.6. Why are we still doing polling? I don't know. I don't think they fixed anything. I don't think it's a news story.
Hugh, I agree with you. And we're trying to de-emphasize polls as much as we can. We're going to take a really hard look at our own polling operation and how we ask questions, who we ask questions to. There's a real top to bottom look at that internally. And I'm just sharing that with you all in your audience. But I think that polls have missed the mark in recent years. We can go back a few elections, and you know the Trump voter is not easily polled. And we saw some real misses. You mentioned Wisconsin. There are others where we're talking 10, 12-point differences. If that happens this time, again, why use them? Even if you're using the Real Clear Politics average of recent polls, it's still garbage in, garbage out if you're missing the mark. So I do think that we as an industry and the media need to do more about getting to diners and talking to people and when I did that in 2016, what I heard was a lot different than what I was seeing in the poll numbers.
And I congratulate Fox News on doing that, because it is broken. It's a broken industry, and they don't know why. A lot of it has to do with cell phones, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that nobody wants to talk to people over the phone about what they believe, because they don't know who they are and they don't trust them. And it's just broken. Brett Baer will be watching tonight at 6 p.m. I may or may not be on the panel. I'm not sure, but good luck. Have a good day in very hot D.C. I've run away. I've gone to the north. I have run away, and I don't know what it is in D.C. I don't care. Thank you, sir. It's the last show I do. I got a note from Howard Kurtz. Do I want to do a Sunday show? I love Howard. I really do. I don't want to do any more shows. The only show I want to do in America is Brett Baer's show. And the reason is because it's a new show and I'm a new show and I talk to people. I'm happy to talk to people. 1-800-520-1234. I'll talk to more people after the break, but it's a new show. I tell you what's going on in the world, and that's what Brett does. And I know that polling is bad, so I don't report on polls except to disparage them. 17 points. I'm going to talk to Jamie Kirchick later in the hour about his new book, Secret City. It's a fascinating book. Coming right back, 1-800-520-1234. We're just kvetching about gas prices, which I think is my show for the next 3 months until the election. Just to remind you, this is all Joe Biden's fault, not Vladimir Putin's fault. It's Joe Biden's fault. We could be producing more gasoline. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. James Kirchick is the author of a brand new book, Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington, which is astonishing and fascinating. The first time James Kirchick was on this show, I believe I talked to him from Ukraine when they were running the elections that led to the revolution. He was there with Robert C. O'Brien before Ambassador O'Brien, long before Ambassador O'Brien became the National Security Advisor. Am I right about that, James? Were you talking with, were you on the Ukraine voting observation when I first spoke to you?
That's a very good recollection, Hugh. I believe you're correct.
Yeah. So when O'Brien called me up and says, James has a new book out on gay Washington and Secret City, I said, well, have him send it to me. Of course, I'll talk to him. I did not expect, though, to be astonished, because I fancy myself pretty smart about the last 100 years of American history. I thought I knew a lot. I didn't know anything about Sumner Wells. I didn't know anything about William Bullitt and Carmel Offey. I didn't know anything about Arthur Vandenberg Jr. I mean, I literally, every page is a revelation to me. Are you getting that reaction from people who otherwise think themselves pretty well informed?
Yeah, absolutely. When you're dealing with a subject like this of homosexuality in 20th century Washington, really Cold War Washington, it was considered such a terrible thing. It was the worst possible secret you could have, worse even than being a communist. And so naturally, the stories related to this theme of this book have largely been hidden from history. And so I spent a long time, you know, digging it all up. And I'm gratified to hear you say that.
I'm pretty amazed at the archival work you did. I mean, you discovered Arthur Vandenberg Jr.'s material, which I didn't even know he existed. He was at Ike's side throughout the 1952 campaign and then was banished by J. Edgar Hoover. I'm going to run through names because I want you to explain stories. This is a book of stories, a book of very tragic stories in some case, and a book of stories of people who overcame. Bob Atoy was a friend of mine back in the California days before he died.
I didn't know that.
I've known a lot of the people in this book, like Bob, and Bob was wrong about everything political, but he was out and everyone knew he was gay. And he went to D.C. with Bill Clinton back in the days when he and I would debate in California Republican circles. So I know some of these people, but I didn't know Joe Alsop was gay. I had no idea that he fell into a Russian honey trap. Absolutely not. And I, you know what? I knew Whitaker Chambers was gay. I didn't. Yeah. Of course, I ask everyone on this show, do you know who Alger Hiss is? I do it because do you know why I ask them that?
I believe you asked it because you want to test their knowledge of American history, the Communist Party in American history. Is that fair to say?
That's it. I want to know if they've ever heard of the Venona Encrypts and that Alger Hiss is a communist spy. And are they willing to budge from their long held beliefs when presented with facts?
Right.
I did not know. I know Hiss Chambers. I didn't know anything about the undercurrent. Would you explain to people, since they've heard me talk about Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers, for the undercurrent of a gay witch hunt that was underway there?
Absolutely. I mean, Whitaker Chambers did have a gay life past in the 1930s. At the same time that he was a member of the of one secret life, he was a secret communist. He was also a secret homosexual. And then in 1948, after he makes his very public accusations about Alger Hiss before the House Un-American Activities Committee, he gets word that the Hiss forces are starting a whisper campaign that he is a sexual pervert, he's a vindictive, spurned homosexual, that this is the reason why he's making these crazy accusations, that he, you know, he lusted after Hiss, Hiss rejected him, and this is his, as Hiss would later call it, fairy revenge. So Chambers confesses his homosexual past to the FBI because he wants them to know in advance. And the Hiss forces, they never publicly make an issue out of this because, well, for several reasons. They're fearful that it might backfire on them, that people might start asking questions. Well, if Chambers is gay, then how did he know Hiss? Did they know each other in, you know, the gay underground or whatnot? So they don't publicly make an issue out of it. But there's a lot of insinuation. I mean, for instance, in the public statement that Hiss released before his testimony, he refers to Chambers as queer four times. Now, the word queer meant something different in the late 1940s, but it also could imply homosexuality. And then during the second perjury trial of Hiss, they bring up a doctor, Dr. Carl Binger, who again isn't explicitly calling Chambers a homosexual, but he's for instance, the lawyer during the case refers to Chambers as a moral leper. Hiss's lawyer calls him a moral leper, and there's all these subtle and not so subtle ways that the Hiss forces are sort of spreading this news around town, around Washington.
It is a fascinating story in Smear, in 1950s Smear. And I also learned from Secret City that Drew Pearson would deal in this crap. Now, I know a lot, you know, I test a book by how accurate it is about Nixon. You know a lot about Nixon, because I know a lot about Nixon. You know about the Solgrave Club, to which my wife's great, wonderful grandmother belonged for 50 years. The Solgrave Club may be the dustiest club in Washington, D.C., but it's also the scene where Richard Nixon saved Drew Pearson from being strangled to death by Joe McCarthy. And there's a backstory to the whole McCarthy era that you unpack here. I know Roy Cohn is gay, and I know he's got a lover on the committee staff. I know all that. That's kind of out there. But Drew Pearson, he is a wicked human being. I mean, he's just an evil, gossip-dealing slanderer. What do you think of Drew Pearson at the end of this?
Well, it's weird. I mean, yes, in some places he's doing that, but he also was an ally of Sumner Wells, who's the Undersecretary of State.
Oh, you're right.
The FDR
I forgot that.
Administration who's really the first sort of victim of the kind of purge of gay people in U.S. government. He's an ally of Wells. He's also an ally of Lester Hunt, who is the senator from Wyoming whose son in 1953 is arrested for solicitation in Lafayette Square, who two of McCarthy's allies try to basically threaten to out this. And he shoots himself. The senator, sitting senator from Wyoming, he commits suicide in his office in 1954. That act becomes the basis for the great Washington novel and later film, Advise and Consent.
Advise and Consent.
But Pearson was an ally of Hunt. But yes, I mean, he is a smear merchant, I think is fair to say. And then later during the Reagan governorship, he's the one who comes out in 1967 alleging that there is this homosexual network in Ronald Reagan's gubernatorial office.
And everyone who has lived in California has heard that story. Jack Kemp is involved, and nobody believes it. It's all made up, but it's all out there. Right. In California politics, I lived there for 30 years. You can't avoid the cabin in the woods story. People deal in that stuff all the time, and you pick up on that. I want to ask you about the source of the concern about gay men and women in the national security apparatus. You note that Guy Burgess and McClain are gay and they're spies. You touch on Kim Philby, who's just a licentious son of a gun. He got lovers of both kinds everywhere on every continent. They defect to the Soviet Union. I've always thought that the national security concern, which, by the way, was gone by the time I ran OPM. I was the acting director of OPM in 1988, its general counsel before then. The anti-gay thing had begun to go away by that point, and it was gone by Bill Clinton. But do you think that's really the anchor? Is that where it merged when the communists from the Oxbridge gang showed up in Moscow?
It starts a little earlier. It starts in 1950, actually, with McCarthy. He gives his famous speech on February 9th in Wheeling, West Virginia, where he's waving around that paper with the names of supposedly 205 communists on it. And then just 3 weeks later, Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, is called to testify about this on Capitol Hill. And he brings along with him a deputy Secretary of State who, in passing, says that 91 homosexuals have been fired from the State Department over the previous 3 years. And this comes as a shock. And it's around that time that these two sorts of concerns, the communist menace and then the homosexual menace, begin to merge in the public mind. You know, both are undetectable, right? You can't spot a homosexual. You can't spot a communist. They're easily disguised. It's believed that, you know, sexual subversives are political subversives. But then, yes, the following year, you have the Burgess case. And Burgess is pretty openly gay. I mean, there's really no hiding. He didn't care about it. And that sort of further cements this conception in the public mind. And there's an article written the following year in Human Events magazine called The Homintern, the Homosexual International.
For the benefit of the Steelers fans, Comintern is the international communist, the Communist International, Comintern. So the Homintern is the Homosexual International Network.
And it's believed that, you know, homosexuals are not loyal to their – it's very similar to anti-Semitism in this sense, and that – homosexuals are believed not to be loyal to the countries in which they live. They're loyal to some, you know, international fraternity. They have dual loyalties. They're conspiratorial. They act in secret, right? They live secret lives, so they can't be trusted. And this persists for quite a long time, this belief.
How much of it do you put down to the fact, and I'm glad that you detailed Joe Alsop walking into a honey trap, a male honey trap, but it's a honey trap. I didn't know any of that. And he does the right thing. When the Soviets or the Chinese communists or anybody tries to blackmail you, the first thing you do is tell somebody at the top of the government, do not go along. It's like the Americans. If anyone watched the Americans, they'll understand what I did at the Department of Justice 83 and 84 was watch the Soviets watch Americans and try and blackmail them. So is there legitimacy at all to the concern that people will not do what Joe Alsop does?
Right. So the Defense Department actually commissioned a study in the early 1990s during the debate over gays in the military. And they studied 105 cases, I believe, of Americans who committed espionage. And there were six of them who were gay. Not a single one of them did it because of blackmail. It was because of money or ideology. The only case that was ever cited of a gay person supposedly, you know, turning over evidence due to blackmail was in 1913, the head of the Austro-Hungarian military counterintelligence, a man named Colonel Alfred Radel. He is discovered to be turning over material to the Russians, the Imperial Russian government. He's given a pistol to kill himself. And the Austro-Hungarian military, because they're so embarrassed, they sort of put out this story that he's gay, that he was blackmailed into doing this. And it's true that he was gay, but it was discovered many years later after the fall of the Soviet Union and the archives were opened, that the Russians didn't even know he was gay. And he did it because he was greedy. He had a giant wine cellar and multiple cars.
It usually is money. There were ideologues in the 30s and 40s, but almost, again, I did this for a couple of years. Almost always it's money. If you look at the FBI agent out in Vienna, Virginia, it's money. The Walker Ring, it's money. Are you going to do a follow-up book on espionage? Because it does seem to me there's a lot of work that you've done on espionage.
I'm really fascinated in espionage. That's really why I wrote this book. I'm really fascinated in the Cold War. And at Yale, I was very fortunate to study under John Lewis Gaddis, who's the dean of Cold War Studies.
You note him in your acknowledgments. As soon as I saw that, I knew why you wrote this book.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what I've always been interested in. I love the Americans, one of my favorite shows. I worked for Radio Free Europe when I was younger in Prague, and I've lived in Berlin. And so I've always had this intellectual, historical fascination in all things Cold War.
And that's why
and I'm also gay.
I should have mentioned
that.
You're also gay.
I realize that there's this huge theme that had never really been explored before in a book. And it comes up during World War II. It comes up in the CIA. It comes up during the bureaucratic battles between the FBI and the CIA. There's a great line from Daniel Patrick Moynihan, where he said, in the era of the security clearance, it was the Harvard men who were checked and the Fordham men who did the checking. And so it's this kind of class. It's this sort of homosexuality becomes a weapon between the blue collar, you know, white ethnic FBI, right? They're using
don't go anywhere, Jamie. I got to go to a break. Don't go anywhere, Jamie. James Kurchick will be right back. The story of the secret city, he writes, of the slow but inexorable increase in acceptance, the expansion of opportunity, extension of rights and responsibilities to citizens unjustly denied that process. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, talking with James Kurchick. I'll be on special report tonight with Brett Baer. Just a reminder to everyone on the panel. James, you conclude Secret City with it. The story of the Secret City is the story of openness triumphing over concealment. But I want to point out, there have always been people, including FDR, I rarely say good things about FDR, for whom someone's orientation on matters of sexuality, he is indifferent to it, provided they are competent. And there is an. Have you optioned this book yet, by the way? Because this is a television series. Have you optioned it?
I'm not. I can't really be at liberty to speak about that. But
all right, that's fine. You're concealing that. But that's fine. The best part of this, what I would pitch as the first episode, is FDR talking to William Bolin about Sumner Wells, because you. How did you get that? And explain to people what we're talking about, because it's riveting.
Sumner Wells is the Undersecretary of State. He's a very accomplished, blue-blooded aristocrat. He's a friend of the Roosevelt family. And he's essentially the Secretary of State, because the actual Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, is this aging guy with wooden teeth who's falling asleep half the time and sick. And FDR is relying on Wells. And in 1940, Wells is on the presidential train, and he drunkenly propositions several train porters. And this news gets into the hands of Hull, who doesn't like Wells. It also gets into the hands of William Bullitt, who's a fascinating character. He's the first ambassador to the Soviet Union. He's a novelist. He's a playwright. He co-authors a book with Sigmund Freud about Woodrow Wilson. Just a fascinating character, but a real devious character as well. And the two of them try to use this against Wells, and they bring the information to FDR. And when FDR first hears this, he tells Bullitt, well, he wasn't doing it on government time, was he? Yeah. He kind of shrugs it off. But there is this encounter. Basically, all the encounters between FDR and Bullitt kept meticulous diaries. And he would, immediately after these Oval Office meetings, he would record the exchanges in his diaries. And they're all at Yale, actually. Bullitt was a Yale grad, and his papers are at Yale. And so I poured through those papers, and I tried to reconstruct his conversations with FDR in the Oval Office as, exactly as I could.
It is an incredible. FDR at one point throws his head back, and Bullitt is more rude to a president than I've ever heard of anyone being to a president in the Oval Office. And so I'm kind of astonished by it. But Carmel Offey, would you tell people is it Pittsburgh? I can't remember quite. He's somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Rural Pennsylvania. He's a young son of Italian immigrants who works for Bullitt. And he's unusual in the Foreign Service in that he doesn't come from an elite background. He's not privileged at all. But he's gay, and he's also relatively open for it. This is the 1930s. And I think he's able to survive because he's so good at his job. He's an amazing stenographer. He's extremely loyal to his boss. And you see this with some of these characters in the book, like Roy Cohn. Lots of people knew Roy Cohn was gay, right? So how was he able to survive? Extremely loyal to Joe McCarthy. Would do anything. And that's a recurring, even with more positive characters like Arthur Vandenberg Jr., who you mentioned, the son of the great Republican senator, very close to Ike, extremely loyal. A lot of these gay people, I think, because they were so vulnerable, they had this secret that they had to protect. They become really the best, most professional, most competent aides to their bosses.
When Joe Kennedy needs to take care of a young Jack Kennedy who's zipping around Europe with Lem Billings, his gay friend for life. Yeah. Joe Kennedy calls up Carmel Offey to make sure he takes care. Right. It's just a really amazing work, James. How is it selling?
I made the Times bestseller list. It debuted at number 9. So I think it's doing pretty well. I'm getting great feedback from people across the political spectrum. I'm very gratified so far.
I read a couple of reviews that have their own, hobby horse reviews are when people want to make the point of their own agenda as opposed to reveal that the book is worth reading and interesting and riveting. How many of those have you come across? Because I read one, which is James Kirchick didn't write the book I wanted him to write. That's the review of a Hobby Horse Review.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really want to speak to any critical reviews. I've been very gratified by the book so far. You know, there might be people who wished I had written a different book, but they're free to write their own book. You know, I mean, this is a big book. It's 650 pages with 150 pages of notes.
It is also, by the way, we have 1 minute left. It's beautifully read by whoever read it. I you sent me the book, but I bought the audiobook because I had to drive up north. So we had 10 hours of Secret City, the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I. My question, I did not know. The first October surprise. I want to make sure I put this in. The first October surprise is what?
Walter Jenkins, LBJ's closest aide, being arrested for gay sex in the basement of the YMCA around the corner from the White House. And LBJ thinks that it's the Russians who did it. He thinks it's the Barry Goldwater campaign that set Walter up. I mean, to his death, he couldn't actually believe that this had really happened. He thought it was some sort of plot.
And that's where the phrase October surprise came from. That's another thing I learned.
Think so. Yeah.
James, congratulations. Secret City is a marvelous, fascinating, necessary book. I appreciate the it's taken you how many years?
On and off for 10 years.
It's a decade of hard work, and it shows. Yeah. It's really fabulous. Thank you so much, James Kirchick. Thank you, America, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. Watch me tonight on Special Report. I'll be on the panel. We should have opinions from the Supreme Court shortly. One of them might be Dobbs. I'll cover that in depth tomorrow if it is, and I'll be talking to you on the next Tubular Show.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.